Jack Boland, the Master Teacher, presents The Sermon on the Mount, A Key to Freedom and Self-Mastery. These lessons are designed to give you the information and inspiration you need to make your life what it can be. And now, here's Jack Boland.
One of the great moments in my life, the turning point in my life, came a number of years ago when I discovered a key that, for me, unlocked a door that had always appeared to be closed for me. It was not a door that you could see. It was like an invisible door that existed in my mind. It was a key that unlocked a door that opened out and revealed to me a new world. There was suddenly, for me, the opportunity to step out of my life as I had known it, to experience an excitement that had been buried within me for my life, an excitement that I think was always there waiting to be rediscovered. I discovered through the Sermon on the Mount, the series of lessons that had been given by Jesus Christ about 1900 years ago and then had been re-reported, not only in the Bible, but had been restated by a great teacher, lecturer, and author by the name of Emmett Fox in his book, The Sermon on the Mount. And the subtitle of his book was called The Key to Success in Life. And I would say that the Sermon on the Mount is not only the key to success, but it's the key to that higher dimension of life. It's the key to more than success. It's the key to understanding and wisdom. And by the way, the Sermon on the Mount, the book by Emmett Fox, was the original textbook of the early members of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to this day still is one of the most valued and valuable instruction books used by that more than 2 million person outstanding group of people. But in the early days, the members of AA would give it to a new person and say, "Here, read this. It will fix you." And I'm going to suggest to you that you read the Sermon on the Mount, because I believe it will fix you. That is, if you are ready to be fixed, if you know that you need fixing. Have you noticed, though, that it's very difficult to fix something that either isn't broken or if you don't think it's broken? And one of our great problems is that we don't think that we're broken yet, and so we don't know that we need fixing. But if there is in you some indication that there's more to your life than you have yet experienced, I'm going to ask you to spend these next few minutes with me and perhaps the following seven lessons, and I will take you on a journey that you will not soon forget. And this journey will be right here, or right there where you are. It will be a journey within yourself, a journey in which you will discover unexperienced and yet powerful, beautiful regions of your own self, of your own mind. And I believe that that is precisely what Jesus the Christ was teaching the people of his time and of all time when he gave them that now famous series of lessons that has been called the Sermon on the Mount. I think that we might better accept it if we called it the Seminar on the Mount, especially some of us. Jesus Christ is really the most important figure that has ever appeared in the history of mankind. And it makes no difference how you may regard him. You will have to concede that this is true whether you choose to call him God or think of him as man. And if man, whether you choose to consider him as the world's greatest prophet and teacher, or merely as a well-intentioned fanatic who came to grief and failure and ruin after a short and stormy public career in which he was overpowered by the prevailing forces of that day. However you might regard him, the fact will remain that the life and death of Jesus and the teachings that have been attributed to him have influenced the course of history far more than any other person. As a matter of fact, you can select any dozen of the outstanding individuals of all time that you yourself might choose. And this one person has influenced the course of human history more than all of them put together. More people's lives are influenced by his doctrines, or at least by what have been called his doctrines, than any other. More books were written and read and bought concerning him, and there are more speeches that have been given about him. They're called sermons. But he has been the most talked about person throughout history, and his influence has been in that period of time in which the earth has been rediscovered or discovered and covered by the growing wave of humanity. And so therefore his influence has helped to dominate and mold the destinies of the entire world. And I'm speaking not only influenced culturally and socially as well as politically, and his religious or spiritual influence has just dominated the unfolding of the experience of mankind. There can hardly, therefore, be a more important undertaking than to inquire into the question of what did Jesus really stand for? What did he teach? And what did he really wish us to believe and to do? What were the objectives that he really had at heart? And how far did he actually succeed in accomplishing what he apparently had set out to do? And also, to what extent has the religion or movement that's called Christianity, as it has existed for most of these 19 centuries, really expressed or represented his ideas? Does the religion that bears his name really represent what he believed? And most importantly, if he should come back now, what would he be saying? How would he speak to or about those very same religions? Tonight, in this first lesson, I want us to talk about what it was that he taught. In the next seven lessons, we'll go into the things that he said, but this evening I'd like for us to consider where he was coming from before he stood up to speak when he gave those series of lessons. We'll find that his teaching is not a mere abstract account of spiritual forces and how they might work. It's not just a cold thesis. But we'll discover that his teachings constitute a practical method for the development of the human soul and for the shaping of our lives and destinies into the kind of reality that we have always wished them to be. There's something in each person that's trying to become what it was destined to be. And I know you understand what I'm talking about. And his teachings were not a set of religious ordinances that one must adhere to if they wish to be blessed by a less than benevolent God, but his teachings were a series of more than practical, of spiritual principles that if understood and followed or adhered to would bring about the most remarkable changes in that person, the one who did it, the one who practiced them, with no exceptions. You see, what he taught is universal. It's not just for religious people or for certain religious groups, but principles that apply to the human entity, to the self of each one. One of the first things that we'll discover is that Jesus explains to us what the nature of God is. He will tell us so that we'll never have to be concerned again about the nature of God. And he will also explain to us what our own nature is. He tells us what our relationship to God is destined or supposed to be, and gives us explicit but very simple, precise instructions on how to achieve or to develop this personal relationship. He tells us the meaning of life and the meaning of death, and he also tells us why we fall short of our potential, why we fail in health, whether it's in the body or in our relationships or in our prosperity. And most important, he tells us how all these difficulties may be overcome and how we can bring happiness and peace and true prosperity into our lives and also into the lives of other persons if they really want to be changed. But he points out, he also tells you that you can't really fix anybody but yourself. And as a matter of fact, he never, ever tried to to change someone who was not willing to be changed themselves, who did not wish or was not ready yet to cooperate with the process. And invariably, when he was working with the people of his time, he told them that it was by their own faith, it was by their own attitude, it was by their own inner involvement that the experience is going to take place. In other words, it's not something, what he taught is not something that can happen to a person from the outside of them. It must happen to them from the inside of them, from a re-evaluation, a regeneration of their own inner state of being. Now, one of the first things that we have to look at, and this first one comes to many people as something of a shocker. The plain fact is that Jesus taught no theology or doctrine whatsoever. His teaching is entirely spiritual or metaphysical. And this means that for most of us, in order to fully understand or to understand at all what he was talking about, we have to step outside of our own orthodoxy, our own valued religious belief system of the past. We have to become willing to open our minds to some new ideas, to some new concepts. As a matter of fact, it was the inability of the people of his day to hear what he said that caused them to crucify him. Now, of course, the crucifixion was something that he helped to arrange. It was, again, not something that happened from the outside. It was something that he was causing to have happen. But you are aware that the tendency of the human mind to cling to its religious belief system is a very dominant part of our personalities. We are programmed through fear and guilt to not dare believe anything except what we already believe. Historical Christianity, unfortunately, has largely concerned itself with theological and doctrinal questions which, although they have no part in the gospel teaching, nevertheless have strongly influenced us. And so it's important for a person to really understand what this incredible teacher was saying, to be willing for a moment to let go of our old ideas. Let me say to you right now that there's absolutely no system of theology or doctrine to be found in the Bible. It simply is not there, and you can go and look for it, and you will not find it. It's not there. The reason that so many of us have not understood the Bible is that we've not had the spiritual or metaphysical key. We have thought it to be a book of dogma, and we have not realized that it was a statement that explained to us that we were spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe, and that we could not really understand our higher nature if we tried to examine our higher nature from our purely intellectual or three-dimensional understanding. The Bible, and most particularly the Sermon on the Mount, is explaining to each one of us that we are more than we have yet believed ourselves to be. But our background, our training, causes us to not be able to believe that in the beginning. How can I be more than I have yet believed myself to be? And so therefore the tendency for all of us is to examine or to evaluate our, not only ourselves but the world around us from our present belief system. And our present belief system is so limited and so faulty that it would be like, and I suppose the best example that I can use at this moment would be the one of examining, suppose you'd never seen an elephant. And you came up on the elephant from one end, and it doesn't make any difference which end you approach the elephant from. It looks strange. Would you agree that that is true? And if, in looking at that elephant from your perspective at the moment, then picture an elephant in your mind right now. It would be hard to imagine the rest of it. Would you agree? From the perspective, your present perspective of that elephant, it's hard to see the other end of it or the other side of it. If you have not seen it before, you would have nothing to work with. There would be nothing in your imagination, nothing in your system of concepts. And so it is with us. We have believed ourselves to be purely human, physical beings, living on a planet called the Earth. And we have not been able to see that in glimpsing just one tiny corner of the universe, and that with only half-opened eyes and working from an exclusively anthropocentric and very small and anthropomorphic concept of ourselves and of God, that what we've done is to build up absurd and very horrible fables about a limited and man-like God. A God who has conducted his universe very much as a rather ignorant and barbarous prince might conduct the affairs of a small oriental kingdom. All sorts of human weaknesses such as vanity and fickleness, anger and jealousy and spite were attributed to this being that has been called God. And then there was a very far-fetched and inconsistent legend about original sin and vicarious blood atonement and infinite punishment for finite transgressions. And in certain cases, an unutterably horrible doctrine of predestination or eternal torment or eternal bliss was added. And so all these things were handed to us in a kind of a package, and naturally, we've had a great deal of difficulty sorting all of that out. And so our belief system then sort of went blank and no longer worked. And that was not only true of people in our time, but it was true in people for all time. And here came this person with real vision and insight and understanding and explained the nature of life, the nature of God, the nature of our relationship with that infinite presence of love. And he was attempting to blow away in his time the concept of a limited God and the limited nature of ourselves, of those beings created by God. And he ran into a great deal of trouble, which was obviously anticipated by him. But that resistance still exists, the resistance in us to see beyond what we have seen. Now, the creed and the dogma that existed in his time was based on the traditions of his people that had developed over a period of many years, traditions that were the result of a way of life that gradually matured, and practices and habits were developed that were very important to persons. But in time, those habits and practices became so rigid that they also became built into the belief system, into the religious belief system. For example, the Pharisees, the time of Jesus, had about 650 things that you had to do every day just to get started. You weren't even started yet. And he was looking at these man-conceived, ritualistic habit patterns that had been built into the experience of a group of people over a long period of time, and he said, they have nothing to do with your spiritual reality or identity at all. As a matter of fact, they are constricting you. They are binding your minds and your concepts, and you are evaluating yourself and believing yourself to be the kind of personality that these limitations are suggesting to you. And he attempted, and as a matter of fact, he struck them all aside. But not the principles, not spiritual principles, just those limiting concepts. He was not a Pollyanna or a cheap optimist. He warned that many times that obstinacy in our self-defeating ways and attitudes would be rewarded with severe punishment, but not punishment from God, that we bring our own punishment upon ourselves. He taught that we're not only punished for and actually, but that we're actually punished by our own mistakes. And he taught that every person, no matter how far down they'd gone, no matter how low they had sunk, that there was hope for them. And immediate and instantaneous hope, as a matter of fact, that they had direct access to an all-loving, all-powerful, perfect parent, God, who would forgive them. As a matter of fact, he taught that God could not forgive us, that the forgiveness was already there. Remember the story of the prodigal son who came to himself, and did his father have to forgive him? Not at all. Not at all. Forgiveness is. It just exists. And he taught it, showed it, and demonstrated. And that was, you have to think about this for some time, because he came from that Middle East region in which forgiveness has never been practiced to this very day. It was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And here he was saying that not only has God forgiven us, but that one of the most important requirements that we have if we're going to achieve our spiritual destiny is that we must forgive all persons for all things. Now that will get you crucified. That is not normal thinking, then or now. Jesus was sadly misunderstood and misrepresented in other directions too. For instance, there's no warrant whatsoever in his teaching for the setting up of any form of ecclesiasticism or hierarchy of officials or system of ritual of any kind. As a matter of fact, he brushed aside the people, the religious leaders of that day, not because they were religious leaders, but because they were imposing upon the people all sorts of rigid disciplines that had nothing to do with their spiritual life. He denounced the Pharisees, and he said, he called them hypocrites, because he said, they love the chief seats and bind heavy burdens, grievous, too grievous to be borne, with all sorts of rules and regulations upon the people. And it was his one of his great conflicts was with the religious leaders of his time. In spite of all this, the history of Orthodox Christianity is largely made up of attempts to enforce all sorts of external observances upon the people. And I don't want to belabor that point anymore, except that it's very important for you and me if we're going to understand the nature of the teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, to really begin to understand that it's talking about inner things, that the spiritual life deals with an inner reality and the breaking up of the old belief system that did not work, and it's something else that's very important. Everything that he taught is something that you don't have to take blindly. You don't have to take anyone else's word for it. Everything that Jesus Christ taught, you can prove to yourself, to your own conclusive satisfaction. Everything. No exceptions. Isn't that incredible? You can prove his system in your own experience. Many people have had difficulty with miracles. As a matter of fact, a lot of people have been embarrassed by, by the fact that he performed those miracles. And by embarrassed, I mean that it would be much easier to believe in him as just a very fine moral person with a sweet psychological system that one would practice and thereby live a better life if the story had not included all of those incredible things that he did that obviously could not possibly be true. And yet they are true. There have been those who have tried to explain away into nothingness his miracles. For example, it was said that on the lake, the disciples were thoroughly frightened until they thought of Jesus, and the thought of him calmed their fears, and this later was exaggerated into an absurd tale that he had come to visit them in person, walking upon the water. They thought about him and they felt good, and then later they said, well, he came walking across the water. Another time it appears he reformed a sinner, raising that person out of his grave of sin. And this was expanded years and years afterwards into a ridiculous story that he had really revived a dead man, and everyone knows that that's impossible. So the stories have gone. Well, his miracles did happen, or the rest of the gospel story loses all real significance, because every day, on every occasion, he was doing some things that were truly remarkable. And never once did he cause a miracle to happen so that attention would be brought to him, so that he could say, look at me, I'm number one. He never said, I'm number one. He said, I am the example. See, it's very important to have the spiritual key and come to understand that he was not the exception, but the example. That he was teaching a system of ideas. Now, he was teaching from the upper end of it. You might say that he would today be classified as a true professional, and the rest of us would be amateurs of whatever rank or level, but certainly not capable of performing at the exalted state of understanding from which he was functioning. But nevertheless, he continued to say, the works that I do, you shall do them, and even greater things. And as a matter of fact, he caused his disciples and other followers, he almost forced them to do certain things that they did not believe that they could do, and he would not let them go. He required excellence from them. He demanded it in an unrelenting and ongoing way. He said, you will think these things. You will, you will, you will. Because he knew that they could. But he understood the resistance of the human psyche, of the human identity. And he said, these things are possible, but you have to know the system. Do you believe that miracles are possible? Well, those who deny the possibility of miracles on the ground that the universe is a perfect system and law of law and order, to the operation of which there can be no exceptions, those persons are perfectly right. But you will admit that there are laws above the laws that are known, and laws above those laws. And so what is a miracle but appealing to a higher level of law in which and from which that experience is the norm. Perhaps one of the examples that we can best understand is that if you have ever been taken to court and the judge or the jury made a decision that was not acceptable to you, you had the right of appeal, did you not? You can go to a higher court. And there the higher court can set aside the verdict of the lower court. And as a matter of fact, if that higher court still does not meet with what you believe your level of justice requires, you can go to a higher court and even beyond. And always the higher court has the ability to set aside the laws, not to set them aside, though they still exist at the lower level, but the higher court maintains a verdict that is above where the lower experience has taken place. And that's what a miracle really is. It's going to the next level of law and functioning there from understanding. Suppose, for example, you had, on a particular day in your life, found yourself consigned to a certain kind of experience. It was not to your satisfaction. Your life was not functioning all that well. You had a problem in your world. It might have been in your physical body. It certainly was in your affairs. Failure was imminent and perhaps to all appearances had already occurred. And the verdict had been given. People had said that you would not recover, that you could not recover, and you'd come to believe it yourself. You were surrounded by judge and jury, usually friends and acquaintances and certain members of your family who know full well that you're not going to get out of this one, sweetie pie. As a matter of fact, you deserve to be there. And if they had had a chance to vote, you'd have been there a long time ago. Do you know them, don't you? Well, suppose that that is the only justice that exists for us. Then there is no hope. Then we must continue with that experience. And this is the normal state of mind of our human consciousness, of our human psyche. Well, in the Sermon on the Mount and in the teaching of Jesus Christ, he said, not so, not so. That you can change your experience by changing your response, by changing your own consciousness, changing your own reaction. And the moment that you become willing to be raised out of your experience in your own consciousness, inside yourself, the moment that you're willing to begin to believe, to think and to feel in a different way, your outer circumstance will change. And what is this change in one's belief system except it be prayer? Is prayer beseeching God to do something for you in an external way? Or is prayer the process in which your own consciousness is elevated, in which you reconvince yourself of other things and other dimensions, and that there is a possibility that you had not conceived of a moment ago that suddenly becomes a living reality that is your experience? And as you are lifted inwardly, so are you lifted in an outer way. I have experienced miracles. And I know that you have too, because many of us have experienced them together. And always they come from within ourselves. They're manifested often in the world around us. But they are there. And the power of prayer was indigenous to what Jesus taught. And he also taught that prayer is both a science, meaning based on principle, but also an art. And he taught this science and this art, and it was made up a major part of his ministry. I looked up the word art before I came in here tonight, and it's defined as one human effort to imitate, supplement, alter, or counteract the work of nature. Isn't that incredible? Think of prayer as an art in which your mind goes to work to imitate, supplement, alter, or counteract the work of nature, believing in a higher law. You show me an artist and I'll show you someone who believes in a higher law and they're working to supplement that law in whatever their art form might be. Art is a high quality of conception or execution. It's being able to conceive of things that others have not seen before and to execute or to implement, to be able to put that higher understanding into action in one's own experience. That's what prayer is. And the moment that you begin to do it inside yourself, your outer world begins to change in the most dramatic way. And this is what he taught. He said, watch it. Let me show you. I'm the example. Art is a specific skill and adept performance conceived as requiring the exercise of intuitive faculties that cannot be learned solely by study. And if that is not a fantastic statement of the spiritual key to the Jesus Christ system, I have never heard it. The ability to intuitively understand and practice things which cannot be learned solely by study, things that the intellect cannot yet conceive of. There's a part of you, this great teacher said, that the intellect cannot conceive of. But the spiritual key unlocks the mystery, not only of the Bible and of the teaching of Jesus Christ, but it unlocks the mystery of the nature of miracles and of the nature of our own eternal existence and identity. To come to understand the spiritual key as he taught it rescues us from all of the difficulties and dilemmas and seeming inconsistencies that our thoughts had developed in the past, but also that we, with which we had surrounded ourselves in our outer lives. He taught, and truth turns out to be nothing less than the amazing but undeniable fact that the whole outer world, whether it be the physical body or the common things of life, the winds and the rain and the clouds and the earth itself, is amenable to a person's thought, and that we have dominion over the world when we know it. But that takes us right back to the first book of Genesis, when we were told that we had dominion and we forgot it, or we no longer believe it. We forgot. And now we're beginning to remember again that we can control our circumstances. Not through our own limited human power, but through an art form called prayer, in which we rise above our purely human identity that says that these things are impassable. He taught that the world around us has no character whatsoever, either good or bad, except the character that we have given to it, and that there's no circumstance that is good except that we have believed it to be so, and that we change our thought. It's like Shakespeare later said, nothing is good or bad except that our thinking has so conceived it and believed it. And he gave us, therefore, freedom from circumstances. If there has ever been a gift given to the human race, it is this understanding that we are free from the circumstances that we have believed have imprisoned us. You're even free from the circumstance that you would call your body. It is not you, and it never was you. And that is also a part of what he taught. And in the lessons that follow, when we get more deeply into these concepts, into this understanding, you'll begin to see that, and to really understand that you never really were your body at all, and that you have nothing to fear from it, even when it ceases to function or even ceases to exist. Well, by surmounting every sort of limitation to which mankind is subject, and he did. He chose. I mean, he made a choice. As a matter of fact, he worked out a little drama in which all of the problems that people have, he worked through them. He experienced them. He said, let me show you how to handle this. Let me show you how to do it. And he did it. Particularly the problem of being put upon by other minds and other people, the problem of being misunderstood. Now, I know that you have never had the problem of being misunderstood. And when you did it, you did not let it confuse you at all, did you? You've never been disturbed by it for 1 minute. Right? Wrong. I know you. I know how you are. I know that you have been. And he was saying, look, I am not the exception. I am the example. Whatever it is that you're going through is wonderful because you can use it now for your growth, providing that you have the spiritual key, providing that you come to understand that your mind, capital M, meaning like spirit, capital S, that your spiritual identity, that which you are, is king or queen, that it reigns, that it is in control to the extent that you begin to believe it. And he showed us how to work through all of these conditions, and also by overcoming death. Long before he chose to be crucified, he had, on occasion, restored other people who had undergone this experience back to their bodies, which means that he really is an incredible person with a very high level of understanding of a higher law and how to practice it. And at a very opportune moment in his public ministry, he decided to sum up the whole teaching in a series of public lectures extending probably over several days and speaking perhaps two or three times a day. And that's why that I said it might be better accepted by some of us if it was called the Seminar on the Mount rather than the Sermon, because we've heard so many sermons. The teaching that is applicable to us. And he dotted the I's and crossed the T's and brought that system forward. Now, let me make a suggestion to you. If you really do wish to change your life, if you're ready to have some remarkable things happen in your world, make a commitment to join with me in these next 7 lessons. I can tell you that unless you're willing to be changed, the lessons won't do you very much good. And so if you're not willing to have something happen, don't join with me for the next 7 lessons, because it won't happen. If you just want to learn something, don't show up, because you won't learn it. It won't happen. This system will not work if you are defending what you presently believe about yourself and about your world. The Jesus Christ system will not work unless you are willing to assume 100% responsibility for your life as it presently is, and also unless you are excited about the possibility of being changed. It won't work unless you are at least willing to examine the possibility that you too are a miracle maker, that you have the same power. If you're afraid to believe that you have the same power, well, show up. Because you might become convinced. And if you become convinced, I can assure you that something incredible will happen. But what happens will take place in your world, in your life and in your world. You see, one of the remarkable statements Jesus was that you must practice these principles in all of your affairs. Not just some of them, but all of them. And that if you will practice them, you will be empowered, you will be reinforced, you will be amazed, you will be astonished, you will be restored, you will be renewed, you will be transformed, you will be recharged, you will even be given a new name, a new nature. That's the way it really is.